Hello, hello, hello. Hello, Georgians, hello, global citizens, and hello, concerned Americans. My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the current co-host of the Politician Podcast, which myself and my high school best friend Damian Galvin created in June of this year to talk about issues that interest us, issues that disgust us, and issues that America needs to know about. In other words, myself and Damian created this podcast to deconstruct public policy issues of the past and the present and create a more equitable future for all of us. We have a very, very special episode queued up for you guys, but before we play this episode, we're going to give a special thank you to our sponsor, Patreon, and our wonderful team here at Politician, which includes high school juniors Jada Pilling, Yi Shen, and Julia Hartman. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we hope that you enjoy. See you in the episode.
And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Politician. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. My name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of the Politician Podcast, and we have a special guest on today. We've been a couple of episodes without a guest, Damian. We've had at least two of them without a guest, and that's a big stretch for us. But we have a very special guest today, as I said. His name is Peter LeGrand. He's a middle school teacher from Chicago, but he does a lot more than be a middle school teacher. He's a very he's very active in the community. So without further ado, I'm going to let Peter introduce himself to all of our viewers today.
Well, good afternoon. It's nice to be with you. I'm Peter LeGrand. And for those of you who are going to be tempted to try to Google me, make sure you put my middle initial in, because I share a name with my father, who is a well-known person in his own right as a photographer. So what'll usually happen is they find my father and they go, "Oh man, he looks really cool. What happened to you?" So I'll make that important distinction, but thank you guys. It's so nice to be with you today. It's a real pleasure. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you on. And so I guess just some context would kind of be important for our viewers, because I'd say that the way that we met was very unique. Unique, not so much anymore. I think I can assume that a lot of people probably get introduced to each other on Twitter nowadays. But I think the fashion of why we got introduced on Twitter was something that's wonderful and something that our viewers ought to know. So as many of you guys know, and kind of getting just some housework out of the way, we're running a toy drive for kids in low-income communities, as we mentioned a couple times now on the podcast. And a part of that was trying to get some interactions on our social media site. And as you know, our consistent viewers will know, we had a wonderful guest on, Blair Erskine. She had an amazing episode. And if you haven't listened to that already, I highly recommend it. But beyond that, we interact with her regularly. I mean, anytime we're doing something big, she always likes to know what we're doing. And she'll, you know, she goes out of her way to help us. She's grown substantially since coming on the podcast. So it's really awesome to have that connection. And she's just a wonderful person. So she did us the favor of putting out a tweet with the GoFundMe. And Peter, if I'm not mistaken, you saw that tweet, and you left a comment, kind of tweeting both at us and Blair, asking if you could donate 120 handcrafted wooden toys. And I think Varun kind of picked it up from there. So if you want to explain your perspective of that, Varun.
I mean, well, to begin with, I mean, I didn't know what to think. I was like, 120 wooden toys is, I mean, it's interesting. And so I messaged him and I was like, well, what does this entail? And he talked to about what he's done before. And that entails a lot of community activism, a lot of community engagement. And it includes, you know, making wooden toys for underprivileged kids, which is exactly what we plan to do. So it fit perfectly. You know, he's been doing it before COVID. We're doing it after COVID, but it fits absolutely perfectly. And I was like, you know, I'll pick this up immediately. And then as I went on with this conversation, I learned so much more about Peter. And that's kind of the reason for why we asked him to come on today, because he's such a kind of tested, experienced individual in many fields. He is the definition of what I call a polymath. You know, he's a lot of talents, but I think nobody better to talk about these talents than Peter himself. So I wanted to ask you, Peter, what is your inspiration behind what you do? Because you do a lot of things. You have the toy drive coming up. You've had it for a couple of years. Sure. You've done the kind of, I forget what it was, but the homeless kind of shelters, the mobile homeless shelters with your middle school students, a lot of things you've done, and more probably. But I wanted to ask you, what inspires you to go out and do these things every single day?
This is only an hour.
Yeah, and it feels like 15 minutes, so
yeah,
brace
no.
for that.
I think at the core of it, I think is I'm almost tempted to say it's something genetic. My mother was very much an activist, and was a Holocaust survivor as well. And I'll get this out of the way quickly, which I think that is a sentence that she used to say all the time that held a lot of truth, which was, after you survive Hitler, everything else is, you know, easy. And there, you know, there is some truth to that. So she was a young girl, and my grandmother, my mother, and my uncle were basically the only survivors of their family in Nazi-occupied Holland, the Netherlands. So that, I think, is, you know, what, you know, that omnipresent question is, you know, is there something I can do? Is there something I can help with? Is there something that a situation needs? And regards to the homeless shelters and the, you know, the toys and all of these different things, that's, you know, those have been responses to asking that question. You know, what can I do to make this better? And I think to an extent, teaching has been a great way, an effective way to impart that to now, I guess, that I reflect with some fear on my age, several generations of students. So there was a joke in there somewhere. I think that's the best probably motivator, you know, discussion.
Yeah.
And incidentally, along the way, it's just been so much fun.
we can relate.
We can understand that completely.
So I would say, not necessarily putting one question or one idea before the other in any sort of priority, but I don't think people ask that question enough in the choices that they make. Is this going to be fun?
Yeah.
You know, this thing that I'm about to do, you know, I'm thinking about doing, you know, and fun is not necessarily, you know, blacking out and having a hangover the next day. You know, fun comes in a variety of, a variety of levels of definitions. So, I think that's the best way I can describe it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the fact that you mentioned that this is only an hour-long podcast, because when we were introduced to each other, Bruin was like, hey, do you want to hop on like a 15-minute call with the guy that wants to donate the toys? And we ended up talking for like an hour and a half.
We
went on for a while, and it was an awesome conversation. And I wish we would have recorded that conversation alongside with this one. But I mean, it really does feel like, I mean, this could be like a 4-hour episode, and you have a lot to talk about. And I mean, it was like the first things first. It was, you know, just the toys, the fact that you did the toys and that you were a teacher, that you made the toys. I was like, man, that's awesome. We should have him as a guest. And then everyone was like, oh, his, you know, mom was also a Holocaust survivor, and so was his grandma. And I was like, oh, wow. It's like, it's almost like four different guests that we would independently have on the podcast just come on in one person. And that's just highly impressive. But I really do love that, you know, that idea of, is what I'm about to do fun? Because I don't even know if we asked that when we started the podcast. I think we came into it under the assumption that we just wanted to do something good. And that we wanted to do something where we could kind of just voice our opinions and vent. But we never, I never at least internally asked, you know, is this fun? Am I going to have fun? And I think the most pleasant thing is when you do something that you love and you discover that it is so much fun. And I think that I've discovered that with the toy drive that we've been doing. It was, you know, it was this thing where it was like, it actually started with a different idea. It started with something that I hope to do as well that I've been mentioning, which is a Valentine's Day drive for single mothers. And I was like, okay, well, I want to get a good basis for that. What's something that a lot of people already do? Because I think the Valentine's Day drive, from what I've heard, is something that's unique. So there was not many people that I could go and get a good foundation from. So I figured, the toys for kids in low-income communities right now, because of so many people struggling with COVID, that must have just skyrocketed, and people struggling to make ends meet. And we actually met a couple days ago with people from the Holiday House, and they said the majority of their I don't know the word for the majority of the people that they help actually aren't people that don't necessarily not have jobs or are necessarily homeless. It's people that just they're struggling, they're living paycheck to paycheck, and the holidays are just hard because of the fact that they're already struggling to pay rent, and now they got to spend so much money on Christmas gifts that it's just something that they can't necessarily do. And I always relate it, I can never understand it completely. And I always love listening to other people's perspectives, but I never say that I can understand them, because frankly, I can't, and I've had that privilege. So I always wanted to know how I can help them. It always reminds me of this one story, and I think that this might have been what got me into it is my one of my dad's employees, who I call my uncle. We've just known him, I mean, since I was extremely little. He's worked with him for over 20 years now. Every Christmas he asks his kids, what do you want? Do you want a meal or do you want toys? Because we can't have both. And it's just that idea of some kids having to choose, especially right now, when we've all, we were talking about the podcast about this being a hard year. We've all had a hard year. And some of these kids, every year's hard. So how can we make that a little bit better? And I think that along the way, I found that this is something extremely fun and extremely rewarding.
Yeah, that's Damien, that's a just a wonderful observation slash memory. That parallels some things that I was recalling as well in my childhood. And we would have to have a lot of a long conversation about if you're if you choose or you're a part if you're a person who celebrates Christmas, that and I'm emphasizing this is my own opinion, but Christmas has become sort of two different things. There's the sort of feels like a shrinking sort of religious observation, but it has become a commercialized venture that I, in my own opinion, a lot of kids are getting sort of indoctrinated into at a very young age. And how big of a pile of toys can you get? I'm waiting to see some commercials that the Catholic Church is having a sale for Christmas to compete with, Target and, all these other organizations, because they just, they just can't match it. But when I was about 10, I think my parents finally were able to buy a house. And the year we moved into the house, we had to make all of our own Christmas presents. And it wasn't because we were utterly lacking and without, it was just that, hey, your Christmas present this year was getting this house. So it's what's the priority? And I think the toys that I make come a little bit out of that,
Yeah,
background as
definitely.
well, but that it's a symbol. It's a way to make a kid forget maybe for 5 minutes, but the rest of their life is just not going very well. And there's a lot of that going on right now. I'm in the Chicago area, and there you're already starting to see stories about the Toys for Tots, and all these organizations are going to have a very tough time this year because COVID, which has become the answer to a lot of questions, sadly.
Unfortunately.
I think that COVID has done a lot to just hurt people around the board. I mean, we've been hurt by it, but I think the people in the low-income communities have been hurt by it even more. I think that when talking about just the commercialization of things, onto your point, I think that a lot of things commercialized. I think that along with Christmas, so many holidays, so many traditions are definitely commercialized to where they lose their meaning. And in a sense, I agree with you. But beyond that, I think that onto our previous point, the reason why we began the podcast was not really to change a human life. It was more to fill our need to create conversation because we like creating conversations. Like you said, we love doing this. But when it gives us the kind of dual benefit of changing human lives, it makes it even more enticing. I think that that kind of benefit, it makes it more fun to me. I think that beyond the thrill of having the podcast itself, the thrill of being able to change somebody's life is something else that definitely factors into our decision for the podcast. But I think that we have to always consider what is goodness and how do we, emulate goodness and give good back to the community. And I think now it's best to question that more than ever, because when you have the resources and capabilities to give back to, racial justice movements, to give back to homeless communities, to give back to people that are suffering in our world, I think that you have, in some sense, a responsibility to do so. Because paying it forward is one of the most powerful things you can do. Now, I wanted to ask you this, because we live in a very affluent place, and a place that doesn't really experience as much homelessness. We have seen it on the outskirts of where we live, but right now, and myself and Damien aren't exposed to it as much. I wanted to ask you if you've been exposed to kind of the deterioration of what's been happening with COVID and how, if you have any personal stories on how people have been set off by this virus, because I think that it is very stressful for a lot of American families in ways that we don't yet understand as much.
Well, you put on your seatbelt. You're gonna love this part. So, actually, I was homeless myself several years ago, many years ago, probably around 2000, 2003, something like that. I'll reference that briefly. That I was homeless for about 9 months due to a family situation involving one of my kids, and we don't need to go in, but I was actually one of the working homeless. I was teaching at the time, and I was teaching at a high school on the west side of Chicago, and my money was going for the care of one of my children who was in severe illness at the time. And so my motivations related to the homeless and the projects I've done with making homeless shelters are probably rooted in that. Fast forward to today, yes, I have two sons biologically, and I have a third son who I just kind of picked up along the way. He used to be one of my students.
Oh, wow.
His name is Tim. I'm not going to give you his last name, but protect his privacy. But he's about 33 right now, and he lives sort of on the west side of Chicago, in a pretty nasty part of town. And he had just gotten himself to a point where, in the last couple of years, where he'd had some employment stability and was starting to do, pretty well for himself. And then COVID hit this year and lost his job. He's got a high school education. He has no criminal record. He is, an incredibly brilliant guy. Was just, is in a really tough situation right now. He's close to being out on the street at this point. And he's somehow keeping it together. He's actually going to come over tomorrow, and we're going to sit in the backyard and play some socially distanced chess. He's a very good chess player.
That's I feel like, it's an impactful story, but unfortunately it's a common story.
Oh yeah, this
Yeah.
multiply it, all over the country. I think the last estimate I saw about homeless in Chicago, and I think those numbers are probably low at this point, was something around 50,000.
Wow.
Now Chicago proper is a city of about 4 or 5 million people, so 50,000 seems a little low to me. But I know, New York, Los Angeles, it's even worse. Atlanta, I don't know too much about, so I couldn't speak to that, but I'm sure there's readily available statistics about that. If you want to solve these things, you got to, it's not a bad idea to look at, what efforts other countries have done. I think it's Finland decided that they simply were not going to have any more homeless people. And my understanding is that they've actually built housing. If somebody goes homeless, they will take you to a house. They will provide for you. They have a very high tax structure. So if there's any Republicans listening right now, I apologize, but they're this is gonna reek of socialism.
We don't have too many. We don't have too many.
Yeah, I think we already turned them all off, Peter.
Yeah, okay, good. Hold your nose. But it's also overcoming the stigma. When I tell people, I'm a college-educated professional who has done a lot of, I have a vast amount of experience in my life. And when I tell people that I'm home, that I was homeless, they typically are in shock. What? It's not a character flaw. It's not a choice. The best of us can have this happen to them. And I think changing the way we look at these people and these situations is also the biggest first step, is understanding that there is probably less than 1% of actual homeless people that chose to be that way. You got to account, you got to make a little allowance that there may be somebody, who did choose that. Okay. But the reality is that, who would choose that kind of life? Well, the answer is nobody does, to speak of.
Absolutely. And something I obviously don't want to tell your story for you, but something that I picked up on when you were telling your story was a flawed to mention, I guess the understatement might be a flawed healthcare system. And something that is so shocking, I think, in a first world country and a country that always claims to be, the best country in the world. And to quote the president of the United States, that we win so much that we get tired of winning. That's a big loss.
Wait, we have a president?
I think there's a lot of people.
Doesn't seem
There's
like.
a lot of people
What?
asking that. There's a
Oh,
lot
wait.
of people asking that question. For the, I think, as Joe Biden refers to him, the man sitting in the Oval Office.
Yes.
For the man sitting in the Oval Office, whether you want to consider him, president or not, he mentions that, and you see this debate right now more than ever. This debate about how we're going to progress forward with the Affordable Care Act, or if we're going to. So, what do you think, from speaking from experience, what is the importance of whether it be Medicaid, Medicare, just better healthcare, I think that we've been lacking as a country altogether.
Sure. Well, this ties in with so many other subjects. Systemic racism. The statistics about how African American people are treated medically versus someone who looks like me. Those stories abound. Black people are, even if they have access to good quality care, they don't necessarily get that, good quality care. So we have to, we have to look at that. We have to look at, how do we view other people? Are, do we agree with the statement that there is systemic racism in this country on many levels? And what part of that, do we each hold? then yeah, access to healthcare for everyone, you know, specifically within the homeless community. If you, you know, you solve that problem, if homeless people, you know, have a place to stay and they have reasonable healthcare, you know, that will solve some of these problems. In the long term, it is cheaper to put a homeless person in some sort of housing than it is to let them be on the streets. The societal costs, you know, and there's studies about this, the societal costs are astronomical. What it costs to, you know, if you have a homeless person out in the streets for 5 years versus being in a home, they don't even compare. So it's this false sense that, you know, that we're giving them a handout, you know, oh my God, you know, how do, you know, you got to lift yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, you know, that is a load of, you know, stuff.
Yeah.
So I think, you know,
that, yeah, there you go. Yeah. Malarkey.
Insert four letter word here.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Right. I did want to kind of talk about this, but we're reaching our 30 minute mark here. So I want to jump to a quick advertisement break and we'll be back here with Peter.
And we're back. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I think Vroon's going to give us a quick rundown, as we usually do, of what we just talked about in the previous segment for those of us that are just joining back.
Right. So a lot of you guys are joining back after a quick break here. So I want to kind of summarize what we've done up to this point, had a conversation about, and we started off with kind of a discussion on homelessness and really how people's lives have been affected by COVID-19. And beyond that, how people's mental health has been affected and things like that. And I think that we've had a very, very productive conversation on what this virus implicates in our community and beyond. You know, Peter Grand is a middle school teacher from Chicago who has a lot of experience in community engagement and has done a lot of things for his community. And I think he told us it all, you know, is rooted in his past and what he's experienced. So I want to talk about what we were talking about before the break, Damien. And we talked about homelessness. We talked about homelessness and moreover, systemic racism and things like that, which are really affecting minority communities and low-income communities across our nation. I think that there's a very strong connection between, you know, between systemic racism and homelessness, because the fact of the matter is that the war on drugs, in my opinion, has really, 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 you know, hindered these African-American and minority communities' access to education, to resources, to jobs, to healthcare, things like these, because incarceration brutally changes a person's life. When a person gets put in jail for a nonviolent crime, such as marijuana usage, you know, selling drugs, and doesn't get reformed, they go out of jail and don't have a job. They don't have a sustainable income, don't have resources, like I said. So it's very likely that one, they'll become homeless, or number two, they'll go back to selling drugs or doing drugs to sustain themselves. And I think that's the main problem with our criminal incarceration system. I think that instead of, you know, working on rehab and diversion programs, we go straight to the jail path. And that hinders our ability to, you know, stop that in the future, because the goal of a war on drugs, any war on drugs, would be to stop nonviolent offenders. And now what we're doing is we're multiplying them in a sense. And I think the only way that we can stop this kind of this outcry and this outpour of homeless people in our nation is by, number one, fixing the COVID crisis. Because the fact of the matter is that even though businesses are open, they're laying off people because they can't sustain their businesses without having a safe environment for customers and for employees. It's hard. And that's why layoffs are happening. But more than that, I think we have to re-enter ourselves into international coalitions. Because when you talk about the topic of goodness, you have to understand that with the U.S. being a very minimal member in the World Trade Organization, not being a part of the World Health Organization, we're losing access to tons of worldwide initiatives. It's hard for a country to prosper and progress without having, you know, input and feedback from the rest of the world on what works and what doesn't work, without having a nationwide coalition, an international coalition, sorry, on healthcare, on trade, on jobs, especially when a virus like this doesn't just affect our country, it affects the entire world. Yeah. So I think that the fact that the U.S. is totally disconnected is, I don't think it's okay, because I think that whoever becomes the next president, it has to be a primary responsibility to stop shunning the world and use the world for our own benefit, because it's going to benefit us. That's what's going to happen, especially with the crisis of this magnitude, like I said.
Yeah.
So, Peter, I want to ask you, well, what you think on the U.S. not being included in things like these, like I just mentioned, international cooperations and agreements, and how that really affects our ability to, first of all, have things like healthcare. Good healthcare. And second of all, to stop a COVID crisis when, you know, right now you're seeing so many nations be conflicting on their standpoints on this.
Wow. You don't know how to ask small questions.
We're used to having politicians on, so if we don't ask them long, very specific questions.
Well, you usually want to keep the political questions, you know, short and slightly monosyllabic. In my family background, you know, my mother came to this country a week before I was born. My parents are both from the Netherlands. I still have a lot of family there. I've had a lot of exposure to a European upbringing. My wife was actually born in Germany as well. So I'm really lucky. I mean, I'm incredibly lucky that I have had a lot of experience to see how other countries operate. There is a certain amount of egotism, egoistic, if you will, behavior in this country that I think is rooted sort of in the, you know, there's a sort of a rough, you have to bear with me, you know, we have something like 5% of the world's population, and we use something like 40 or 45% of the world's resources.
Wow. Yeah.
And that statistic tells you a lot. You know, if you sort of peel away the layers of that, you know, it's this, we talked about it in the front end of the, you know, the broadcast about the commercialism, you know, that we are, the American society is, you know, is really dedicated to commercialism. And even, you know, if you look at the commentary about the economy recovering, you're going to hear these sentences about, you know, people are going back out and buying stuff. You know, you'll hear some variation of that sentence. As if that is the number one priority. And I get it. I go to the stores. Well, not anymore, but we buy stuff. You know, you look at other countries and how they solve some of their problems. You know, there's common sense. I have a very old story, and I'm a storyteller, and I'm staring at the stage in my backyard that I tell stories on. I took my kids to Holland when they were real young to visit because I wanted to start exposing them to that early. And the first day my family still had a house there in the little town where they lived. And the first day we were there, I got my boys up and I took them to the front window because it was garbage day. And I wanted them to see how they took the garbage in another country, especially in Holland. And outside of every house, there was a little three-sided concrete enclosure with three garbage cans inside of it. And down the street come three garbage trucks. And the first truck comes and picks up the first can, which was compostables, which they took to the town garden area and they made compost, which you could then at a later date go and get and put in your own garden. It was for, you know, for your own use. So it stimulated gardens, food production. Okay. The second can was recyclables. And the second truck would take the recyclables, and then it would also take the third can, which was whatever didn't fit in the first two cans. Okay. The last truck was a steam cleaning hot water and soap truck that came and cleaned out all the garbage cans and the enclosures.
Wow.
Now, why do they do that?
Let's see. So I think for the first one, just for a guest that might be scared of socialism, this I think that idea that compost for the first one, you guys can cover your ears for just me answering this question. I think that it's a great thing. I think that it provides a resource. First of all, it's great for the environment. And I think Varun can just talk about this a little bit more, that it's a natural kind of fertilizer.
Yeah, you're overthinking it a little bit. Why would they have a dedicated amount of resource to clean all the garbage cans every week?
Let's see. I can't. I mean, would it
I
just
feel like
not
it's
attract
my
animals?
Tongue, but I just can't.
You're on the right track, Damon. Yeah. You know the rat problem that we have in this country?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't have it in Holland.
Well, there you go.
Huh.
They don't have a rat problem because they clean all the garbage cans.
Because rats hate socialism.
Yeah, exactly. That's I'm putting that on a t-shirt. Rats hate socialism.
That's but, awesome. Yeah.
But it's such a, the point of this whole, you know, we're taking a lot of time here, but the point is that this is such a, it's an elegant, simple solution to a problem that, you know, what we do and what they do in Chicago here is they go and they bury rat poison around all the dumpsters.
Oh, wow.
In the ground.
Talk about ineffective, you know?
Yeah. Right. Ineffective and harmful.
Because to the best of my knowledge, they have figured out, the city of Chicago has figured out that rats can't read. So they put big signs above all this saying, warning, buried poison, you know, in the ground. Okay, so, but inevitably, there's a couple of stories every year about some dog that digs it up and dies. You know, when it rains, it leaches into the groundwater. I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah, yeah, okay. It's horrible.
Who knew the solution was soap and water.
Yeah, right. And then the thing is, when you have later generations that are drinking this water, and then you're trying to save money by not doing what Holland's doing, right? That's the idea. You're trying to save money and not pay as high of taxes, but then you got to pay this high tax because you have to pay for everyone else's health care, or you have to pay the premiums for your own health care. So it's you try to be cheap one end, and it always ends up coming out the other. And I think that that's something that you probably learn.
To come back to the original point, what can we do? Well, we have to be more willing, as a country, to be open and accepting about solutions, that exist elsewhere. That, that things that are working, in a country that demographically kind of lines up with our, I'll use Holland as an example. Holland has multicultural, racial makeup. There's white, there's black, there's, everything. They're not, demographically that different from us. Wait a minute. I know. They're also human beings just like us. Oh, that's it.
Yeah.
The great equalizer.
Right.
We don't, but we're, we're very egotistical about, about how we approach these things.
Absolutely. It's always the American idea and the American kind of us knowing how we do it because it's in America. And I think that we need to step away from kind of the isolationist perspective. But have you ever thought about running for public office?
Oh, no.
That's interesting because you remind me a lot of a past guest that we had on, Jason Bosky. I don't know if you were getting this vibe. It's kind of a, both of you are he's a pilot, he's a wrestler, he's a comedian, he's a story. I mean,
you know what he also is? He's a storyteller.
Yeah, he's a storyteller. He had his own podcast or his own radio show rather.
Radio show.
And now he's a politician and he kind of brings all his experience into it. So I was just wondering because you both unique backgrounds, and I mean, I just think that it would be a fitting kind of tale to see how both very different paths can culminate into the same thing.
I have too many skeletons in my closet. And once they found out about that week in Miami, it would be it. I wouldn't be elected anymore. Anyway.
Well, you see, I think the president has set a new
precedent.
I think that you should run for, the highest office in the land. And I think you could get away clean with it, because I don't think that there's, unless you have some Access Hollywood tapes that are worse than
No, I don't.
what we already have.
I'm very, I actually, I have a little bit of a standard. I guess I've gotten to the point where, it drives me nuts dealing with people who live in bubbles.
Yeah. Well, we're all in bubbles right now, unfortunately.
I mean, honestly,
Well,
I think
yeah.
the beyond that, even now, I was talking about this before, international kind of relations. We live in a bubble. As America is so isolated from everybody else to where we stop caring about human beings. It's first of all hyper partisanship. More than even us and other countries, it's us Democrats and Republicans.
Yes, yeah.
It is the hyper-partisanship in our nation is incredibly, incredibly extenuated today. I think that it has to be solved for us to have
Oh,
any
yeah.
chance at progress. And I had a point to bring up, and forgetting my point, but
This
I'm gonna hand it off to Damien.
is the second episode in a row, Varun. We got to get you
This is the
tested.
second episode.
You keep acting up
The
like
second
Joe
episode,
Biden. You
man.
keep forgetting things.
There's
Gotta
going to
get
be
it.
enough. That's going to be a pod. Just you got to save when you remember them. Then you have to have a podcast to go over
I
each
got it. I
step.
got it.
There you go.
Yeah,
The sticky notes.
I wrote this stuff down. I got the sticky notes. I got them on my hand. I wrote down best, and what that means is that the U.S. and our constituents think we are the best country in the entire world, and I think that that belief needs to be not squashed, but kind of put down, because we're not the best. We're far from the best, and I think that to have any chance of progress on things like climate change, healthcare, the economy, I think that we have to stop considering ourselves as the best. And as you said, in places like Holland, they may have better systems than us. And I think that if we recognize that and even open up our minds, instead of being so bunkered down, we'll be able to progress as a nation even better.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the American dream. It's progress, it's advancement, and it's not ignorance. And that's what I see in our nation. I think that's why we're veering from what our founding fathers put forth for us. They put forth progress, and we are ignoring the chance for progress.
Yeah.
And we're
Absolutely.
assuming we are the best nation.
Yeah.
And I think that first of all, cooperation does it. Second of all, mutual respect for human beings does it. And this goes beyond international relations. It goes into our presidency. It goes into our constituents. It goes into how we handle presidential debates. A human decency is extremely important.
Well, Varun,
And I think that,
you wanna?
when you risk, when you go ahead.
Yeah, no. I was just gonna say, something that I think about anytime that we're having this conversation about the best, is something that my mom and my parents always tell me, and it's never think that you're the best at something because there's always someone out there that's better than you. And I think that Americans have forgotten that idea, right? And I talked about it on our last episode, where Joe Biden mentioned that we're a house divided. We always have been. It wasn't an idea in 1860 what three was it that the Gettysburg, what was it, five, that Gettysburg? Ooh, Varun, you're gonna have to correct me on this one. When was Gettysburg Address given? Pop quiz.
Damien, I'm sorry, I have literally no idea. But the
All
internet does.
right.
Hey,
Well,
the internet does.
I got this. In the 1860s, it wasn't just the 1860s that we were divided. We've always been divided, but as I mentioned on the last episode, we've been divided, but we've always bettered ourselves. Where it's, we've always been a house divided, and I used this analogy last time. It's if one side of the house would buy a cool couch, the other side would buy a better couch and propose it to the American people, and then the other side would have to go and buy a bigger TV just to make sure that the other side didn't have a better thing. And that's how we've always bettered ourselves. But I think that we've gotten onto this idea where it's like my couch is better than yours, regardless of what you say. And I'm not going to change it, even though it's 200 years old, and that my system is extremely flawed. And we've been using the same system since the 1890s when we proposed the idea that we wanted to become a world power. Because that's kind of when the isolationist idea even started, right? 1890s when we started wanting to colonize everyone.
That you touched on something that I firmly believe. I've been a woodworker since I started working with wood when I was in middle school. I was probably 10. As my, I still have the first thing I ever made out of wood. It's in my cutting board I made for my mother. It's in my kitchen. But somebody several years ago said, "Oh man, how does it feel to be a master woodworker?" And I thought about that and I said, I don't want to be considered a master woodworker. I don't want to be considered the best at anything, because what I'm afraid of is that when I start thinking of myself that way, I'm not keeping myself open to learning new
Yeah.
things. And I think sometimes the United States thinks of itself as the, you know, we always say the best country, or the best, you know, we are not willing, you know, if we hang on to that attitude too closely, I don't think we leave ourselves open to learning new things. I'm in my work with Holocaust education, which is I'm actually going to start that as a separate entity, company, where I'm hopefully teaching Holocaust education full time, hopefully around the country. I've been reading People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn.
Yeah.
And it, you know, oh, it's so sobering. We, you know, we have not taken good care of each other in this country. Now, the rich white folks have, my apologies, you know, but we really have not, you know, done a good job of taking care of each other. I think in many respects we are, you know, very good at certain things, but certainly in the last, I think it's definitely has accelerated since Trump was elected. You know, there's things that are happening now that parallel so much that happened pre-World War II, the language, the divisiveness, the you know, not calling out white supremacists. What was it last week? Stand back, stand by.
Yeah.
Stand back and stand by.
Yeah.
And said in a
What?
weird cadence.
Yes. You know what? How do you, you know, how do you tolerate that? You know, how do you accept that as something even close to, you know, what, you know? And then, you know, the governor of Michigan with a, you know, a basically, you know, a plot against her life, you
Yeah.
know, by
Yeah.
some of these very groups. You know, drove me nuts. I was reading some stories about it this morning. They're calling them militia. They're not militia, they're terrorists.
Yes. Yeah, they are terrorists. And something interesting is now that you know you're making these kind of these draws back to you know pre-World War II, it's very interesting. We read Donald Trump's tweet yesterday for our episode that is coming out today, I think in about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
We read his tweet out loud, and now that I'm thinking of it was very I was very passionate when talking about it because it was disgusting. It was a disgusting tweet. But his tweet basically said, for those who need a synopsis, you deserved it because you spoke up against me. And
Yeah.
that is scary. And you know, the last thing you want to do is draw parallels to Adolf Hitler, right? Because if you want to talk about the worst, you know, one of the worst humans of all time, you have to talk about Adolf Hitler. But what else can you do? I mean, this is something where it's that exact idea where it's like we're gonna burn down your building and you know start the Nazi regime if that you know if that's what you I'd say that was kind of the point, right? When they burnt down the can't remember the name of the building, but you know they burnt it down. They blamed it on communists and on Jewish people, and
Sure.
they were like, this is why we need to have power. He's doing the exact same thing. In the same tweet, he blamed it on Antifa and on
Yeah.
left-wing mobs. And it goes to this parallel where you're just creating divisiveness and you're creating fear. And they always try to blame the left for doing that. And it's so clear why. They're scapegoating.
You know what? You can love it or hate it, but the techniques that Hitler used, he used them because they worked.
Absolutely.
They were powerful. And you know, we are now 80 years, you know, close to 80 years past, you know, well, he obviously, you know, we think of him in the context of World War II, but you know, he started his mischief before World War II. But he murdered 39 of my family in a concentration camp in Poland. You know, is to, and those techniques started, you know, when you if you walk through history, you know, they started as you know, these sort of mild things. Everything would just get amped up, you know, a half an inch. Mm-hmm. And you would get sort of acclimatized to hearing, you know, nasty things about Jews. And, you know, over time, it just built up and it built up and it built up. You know, now we have, you know, people hurling, you know, horrible things and attacking Asians, you know, or people of Asian descent or you know, I mean, and it's their fault that we have COVID.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you make that connection? Mm-hmm. How do you make that connection?
Yeah, and you know, it's this. I want to let Varun continue here, but it's this idea that can't happen here. You know, that can't happen here. This is America. That negligence, it repeats itself. It's a common theme in kind of the conversation that we're having, where it's that idea that since we're the best, there's no way that can happen here. We saw it happen here in the 1940s with internment camps. We're seeing it happen today. I mean, if you want to draw the parallels to what's happening at the border with the ICE detainment camps, it's those kind of – and I think Varun said something powerful yesterday when I was reading the tweet. It's – I become numb to it.
Mm-hmm.
You become That's numb to the presidential remarks. Numb. Exactly. But I want to let Varun continue on that idea of kind of becoming numb to these ideas and these remarks.
Yeah,
I definitely want to continue, but I wanted to let you finish, Peter. I don't know if you finished your whole point.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, that's about it. But because I was raised, you know, we're running out of I'll sort of make a small circle here. We're running out of Holocaust survivors. You know, I saw an estimate within 5 years, there will be a media story about the last Holocaust survivor dying. Because they're at this point, they're all in their late 80s, you know, 90. And so I'm going to be the closest thing you can get.
Yeah.
You know, because my family was touched by it. My point is that, you know, when I got into this because I ran into people of your generation who did not know, one guy in particular, who is a lovely guy, I still have contact with him. We got to know each other through a volunteer cause I was in, and he was making sort of offhanded remarks about Hitler, you know, and I said, you know, I got to tell you, John, that really doesn't land well with me. And I don't know if you knew this about me, but I'm the son and grandson of Holocaust survivors. And he looked at me and the color drained out of his face. He just went completely, you know, white. He said, I am so sorry. He says, you know what? In my life, he was like 21 at the time. He says, I've never met anybody who is connected to the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And that's one of my biggest fears and probably motivators is that if we don't pay attention to what happened 80 years ago, if we don't pay attention to what we did to African Americans in this country, you know, during the time of slavery, you know, if we don't take these lessons that are coming out of the 1619 Project, out of, you know, all these amazing, you know, groups that are trying to, you know, re-educate us, you know.
Yeah. History repeats itself.
Yes, absolutely.
I think the honestly, it begins with us speaking out. Because, you know, like you said, we have Holocaust survivors dying. I think that right now, the reason for why we even, you know, support things like Black Lives and recognize racism is because people speak out. And we have living examples, core examples of what this actually means. Now, I think that one of the biggest issues in our society, and Damien and I have talked about this for a long time on the podcast, and this is cancel culture. For us, it's a huge issue because I think that it limits the ability of somebody to change. You know, I almost compare it to like, I made this comparison yesterday. I forget what I'm doing again. I'm a little bit jumbled today, but I just think that cancel culture, it just stops the human ability to change and just to become better. I think that I have to believe in humans, because we're built to know, to have a moral conscience and things like these. So I never give up on individuals. Now, I think that one of the biggest issues is that people are brought up in ways that prime them to towards a certain way of thinking. Like I said, the 1619 Project is a revolutionary thing, but what it really brought up was the fact that our high schools and colleges don't actually give the right education on things like racism, on things like the Holocaust. Because, well, I've been doing research on this for my own personal edification and for a personal project, but what I noticed is that in our high school standards for U.S. history, the word slavery is mentioned a total of 3 times out of 15, 16 pages. And in the context the word slavery is mentioned, it is in connection to other things. It's not slavery as a concept. And I think that we have to understand that we can't ignore slavery. Even though it's an uncomfortable subject for many Americans, we can't ignore slavery because slavery built this country. Slavery is part of what this country is, and slavery is something we should learn from. I've always believed that history is the purpose of history is to learn from it. And we can't learn without recognizing the past. And I think that our high schools and colleges have to incorporate more training, and not only on the political and social things that happened back then, but on this, on the more cultural things that happened back then, because the culture of slaves is something that isn't represented. And in talking about politics, in talking about the economy of the pre-Civil War age, what happened is that you don't recognize anything but the history of white folks. And that's the issue. Now, I want to talk to you about something that I think is extremely important. High school and college, you know, teaching and standards that reflect slavery and the Holocaust and things like these uncomfortable concepts, like the New York Times puts it, hard history. What do you think about what we're doing right now? And do you think it's sufficient what we're doing right now?
No, I think you've already very eloquently stated it. It's, you know, I think there's in general, the version of history that is presented to our children in school is skewed towards making white people comfortable. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you are familiar with a guy, he's an actor, John Leguizamo, has an amazing Netflix play. And I actually was lucky enough to see it in New York. And it's he did a one-man show called Latin History for Dummies, or for morons.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Yes.
And he talks about the Latin Holocaust, about which those numbers, you know, make the Jewish Holocaust of World War II actually pale. Yeah. You know, he estimates something. I don't want to say a number, but I know it was, you know, significantly larger than the Jewish Holocaust. Now, of course, we're talking about hundreds of years ago over a longer period of time and things like that. But we don't teach that. You know, I taught history in middle school, and, you know, because I am who I am, and I'm going to probably annoy some people, I did teach that, you know, about the Latin Holocaust. But, you know, Varun, are you familiar with the Latin Holocaust? You know,
I'm not.
You know, the Tainis, who were, you know, wiped out, most peace-loving tribe in South America, were wiped out by the Spanish, who wiped out cultures simply by showing up and exposing these new cultures to the diseases that they brought with them.
Yeah.
Wow.
They figured that out. They figured out that their strongest weapon was to just simply walk through the crowd. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, the prototype of COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And the interesting thing about it is the issue isn't necessarily that. The issue is that the history is taught as what really won them the kind of, I guess if you would call it a war in that sense, or what really won them the territory was these massive weapons that they brought with them and these technological advancements and their brain power, when it was simply the fact that the losing side of history didn't have exposure to something that they had already built immunity up to. And our history has been taught wrong in that sense. And I think that that's an amazing, you know, he talks a lot more about what's happening in America right now, and he ties that all in. It's highly recommend it. I remember watching it a while back.
Cannot recommend that show enough. It's got some, if you're offended by language, he's got some language in it, but you know, but he just is, you know, amazing.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Makes the case.
Absolutely amazing. And, you know,
so, yeah, no, I mean, We need to, you know, start showing our kids Black Panther movies as part of their history.
Yes.
You know, we need them to, you know, do research. They need to, you know, read a lot of books and have a lot of conversations. And they need to read, you know, The People's History of the United States, which is not an easy book to read. And you know, as a teacher, I could probably make a, you know, curriculum for an entire year on that book alone, you know, given the breadth and depth that it goes into. Mm-hmm. But we don't, you know, we're not doing that because that just doesn't fit into the narrative that we have spun about ourselves. And, you know, speaking as a person with absolute, you know, ownership of white privilege, I have it, whether I like it or not, that is, you know, part of who I am as a human. I have this privilege. But to have those conversations, you know, last year I had a kid about the second week into school called me a racist, and he thought that I was going to flip out. And I just sat there for a minute and I said, you know, you may be right. I would like to say that as a good person, you know, or somebody who thinks of myself as being a good person, that I can walk through life and not be a racist. However, I do have to acknowledge that there may be situations that I've been in and that I'm in now or will be, where I behave in a way that could be considered, you know, racially insensitive. I have to own that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we don't, but it's I don't about, think we do yeah. that.
I think it's about even considering the fact that, you know, I can be racist at times inherently, not knowing so. Because as much as racism is sometimes explicit, a lot of times, especially today, it's implicit and you don't recognize it and you don't know you're doing it. But I think that sometimes people, you know, implicitly have that kind of bias that hurts our nation even more. And what hurts our nation the most and our progress the most is that people fail to even consider the possibility of implicit bias, of systemic racism, as we saw the vice president do this Wednesday.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, if you want to talk about it, Varun, what was the president's remark? I want to get rid of racial sensitivity training. Why? You know, because and then some people said because it's racist, because racial sensitivity training is racist. And then moreover, you have this idea where if you talk about the dark parts of American history, you're all of a sudden unpatriotic. Right. If you mention the things that we did wrong, and Donald Trump has, you know, mentioned that the president of the United States has said that he's going to change our curriculum. Again, you know, you hate to draw parallels, but if you're just going to have this, you know, this patriotic curriculum where we've never done anything wrong and blame this culture, blame that culture, and not acknowledgement in no acknowledgement of our past wrongdoings onto other people. You know, that's negligent and I'd say that it's criminally negligent and that it's harmful.
It's untruthful. It's a lie.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But go ahead.
That goes to the makeup of who he is as a person, you know, and what, you know, what his own belief structure is. So, you know, but how, you know, when you're the president of the United States, you got to do better. You got to acknowledge that there's more than one way to look at something. And we are currently in a situation where that just is not happening.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
If I may add, we've said this before, Damien. I think that the problem with what we're having today is the fact that this president runs away when he sees something that is a failure or that is a miscarriage by him. He runs away. As a president, your job is to face the issues. With COVID-19, he ran away. You know, with talking about healthcare, he doesn't have a plan for it. Essentially, he's trying to run away. You know, there is so many instances I can tell in his past and his present in which he runs away. And I think that as a country, we can't run away from the issues. We can't run away from our past. Our past deserves a place in today.
Well, he just can't accept that he's wrong. And I think that that's something that we need to all learn to do. And it goes back to kind of the TED Talk conversation that we were having about, we're kind of, let's see what happens if the meeting ends. We might, there says that there's less than 1 minute. So let's roll some dice and let's see if it adds time or if it ends the call. But I'm going to go on with this idea that I was saying. It was, you know, not being able to admit that you're wrong and grow from your mistakes. If you want to talk about, I think, the most surprising thing or the most obvious instance of that with regard to the President of the United States is the Central Park Five. I mean, how can he not admit after the fact, after if you want to talk about beyond a reasonable doubt, you'd have to think beyond a reasonable doubt that they didn't do it, right? Well, there you go. We rolled the dice in the meeting. The meeting just ended, so I'm here talking to myself. But let's try to get back on a call. We'll be back in half a second with that footage of us joining the call.
Hello, 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 everybody. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Politician Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/Politician Podcast for more exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. That is, once again, www.patreon.com/Politician Podcast. I'm going to make it a jingle when I grow up. It is www.patreon.com/Politician Podcast. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. But definitely visit www.politicianpodcast.com. For more amazing content from myself, Damien, our team, our amazing artwork head, and our sponsors over at Politician. And once again, thank you so much for watching today's episode. Thank you to my co-host, Damien Galvin, for an amazing conversation. My friend, I do appreciate your input as always. And that said, have a great rest of your weekend. Chime in for the next episode, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation.